following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
On the 13th floor of a corporate tower, they created a gateway to a parallel universe.
So this is where I was born.
But when you open the door...
You think one of them units crawled up the extension cord and killed its maker?
Beware of what you let in. The 13th floor.
Hey, what'd you do to the world?
Turned it off.
Rated R.
Greetings, programs. I'm Mike White. Joining me in the projection booth is Rob St. Mary.
Is it live or is it Memorex?
This week we're looking at Joseph Rusnak's 1999 film, The 13th Floor. The film stars Craig Bierko as Douglas Hall, an exec at a computer facility that has created an incredible simulation of life via a virtual world where it seems that everyone he knows has a sim counterpart, including himself. When his boss ends up dead, the police suspect Hall for the murder, but he feels something else is going on, something bigger, and the secret may be locked inside the walls of the virtual world. Let's just say right off the bat that this exploration of alternate realities had the misfortune of coming out just 2 months after another little film that had some similarities to it, something called The Matrix. Thus, The 13th Floor was not only overshadowed by the much more action-packed film, but it was also labeled as a ripoff. That's very much a misperception, as the screenplay by Ravel Centeno Rodriguez was based on the 1964 novel by Daniel Galouy, Simulacron 3. All right, Rob, so what did you think about The 13th Floor?
Well, this is the first time I had a chance to see it. I do agree with you that it did suffer from the fact that it came out too close to The Matrix, because from the way it was marketed, I had no interest to see it because I had already seen The Matrix. Kind of wish I would have saw it back then. I probably would have appreciated it a bit more when I was probably 20, 21. I thought it was good, but it's not mind-blowing like I was hoping it would be. As a matter of fact, I find both the films that are based on this book, which obviously a book I have not read because, as you know, I'm functionally illiterate, I think they both have merits that are wonderful unto themselves, but if you could come up with some sort of third option, it might even be even better.
The 13th Floor, they're taking Galouy's novel and they're really kind of interpreting it through a film noir aesthetic in some ways, because you've got the modern day world, which at that point was 1999. You've got the modern day world. You've got the alternate reality, which is set in 1937. So you kind of are shooting everything in 1937 Los Angeles. You're seeing the buildings being built and all this kind of stuff. A little, you know, it's a little pre-war to really call it a film noir. But then to, let's just say right off the bat, I mean, you mix film noir with science fiction, and usually you're going to end up with some sort of a Blade Runner thing. I mean, we're going to be talking about that one in 2 days here. Yeah, with this one, not quite Blade Runner-y, not quite Matrix-y, and it's kind of a weird hybrid that you've got going on here. But I do like some of the ideas that they have, but it's not really incredibly clear, like, even why they are building this simulacron world inside of this world of 1999. I know we'll talk more about that as we get into it, why you would do that. But, it's a little funny why they would. And then, and I should probably say, we've got to really talk about spoilers in this episode. So hopefully folks have taken the time, gone out and watched this on Netflix Instant or rented it or whatever, because really a major facet, and I think one that is becomes fairly obvious as we're watching this pretty early on, at least for me, is that
spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert.
The thing that they consider the real world, this 1999, is not the real world, that there's something built on top of that.
Yeah, definitely. I think going back to your question, at least within the 13th floor, as to why to consider a simulation, is probably what the producers decided to do is, instead of having a bunch of exposition or some sort of, you know, grander philosophical goal, which we'll talk about later when we talk about World on Wire, it's just because they can. You know, the idea that I think most people, if you ask why science is done, they'll just say, well, they did that because they could. It has, you know, there's no real basis in trying to create something that's going to improve humanity. They just decided to do it because they could. And I think we see that play out every day on the fast food menu of most restaurants that you would go through the drive-thru. Why do they find the need to pair these weird objects together? Because they can.
Why is there a McRib?
Because they can.
Let's go ahead. We'll give away the secret as far as why they built the world inside of Daniel Kaluuya's novel, which was that it is a way to test marketing. The world of Kaluuya's novel is beset by people that are trying to take opinions. These pollsters are everywhere, and it's become a plague. So the guys in this world decide, we're going to create this simulation where we can have all of these fake people inside of it, and we can change the variables inside of their world and see, you know, if they, you know, maybe make the price of margarine go down, or give, you know, cigarettes an extra zing, or, you know, even just change the wording of stuff. I believe they have a lot of different billboards and stuff inside of this world. So by doing that, they're hoping to put the pollsters out of business is basically what they're doing. So it's not a really crazy science fiction idea, but it's a nice one. It's basically, you know, so now you can sit down at 5 o'clock and have your meal when you come home from work and not have to worry about being barraged by people that are giving you phone censuses or, you know, all these surveys and that kind of stuff. So it's smart. And that it's also an idea that had been explored previously in a short story by Frederick Pohl called Tunnel Under the World, which I think is actually even more effective because it's only about 50 pages, and it kind of really takes those ideas and makes them a lot tighter than what Kaluuya was doing. I like Kaluuya's work, but he kind of gets a little drawn out at times.
You know, it almost kind of sounds like it would be a nice companion for people who like things like Mad Men, which, of course, is all about advertising and marketing. So maybe would you sort of see that this would pair well as an idea and sort of counter-programming to Madison Avenue?
Yeah, I think so. There's kind of a similar story by Philip K. Dick, too. I know, like I said, we'll be talking more about Dick in a couple of days when it comes to Blade Runner. But he wrote one called Time Out of Joint that I've seen compared to Simulacron 3 a few times. It's a big stretch to say that these two are fairly similar. I would say that Time Out of Joint is more similar to the 13th Floor movie than the book is to Simulacron 3 by Kaluuya, because there's this whole like throwback to 1950s or earlier kind of times, earlier, simpler times that this guy has set himself in, and he's doing this daily newspaper contest, and then he eventually finds that his world is just this kind of like encapsulated fake world, and that if he goes outside of the confines, it's actually much later, and it's this kind of post-apocalyptic world that he has actually kind of created himself, because he was one of the people that was involved with this war that had happened. But I would say, yeah, if you're going to really look for something to compare the 13th Floor movie to, it would be better to compare it to the Dick book than it would to the Kaluuya book, though the Kaluuya is, it's fun. It's a nice read, and his other stuff is good too.
One of the aspects of this film is taking on sort of the detective aspect, the sort of film noir-esque, I guess, and putting it within this context. How do you think it works within the 13th Floor?
Well, I like that we've got a couple of investigations going on, that we've got the investigation from Detective McBain.
This is Dennis Haysbert, who I love. I love Dennis Haysbert. He does a good job in this. He looks a little different than what I'm used to. I'm used to him being not as scruffed out. Dennis Haysbert, for those who may not know him by face, he's the guy who was doing all those Allstate ads for a long time. I got wind of him through actually Todd Haynes' film Far From Heaven, in which he is in there with Julianne Moore and does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, I like that we've got multiple detective stories going on. We've got Douglas Hall investigating what had happened to his boss. And to do that, he tends to go back into the machine, takes him into 1937. And then you've got McBain investigating him in 1999. So it's kind of nice. It works on multiple levels. It reminds me a lot, too, of, I guess not necessarily The Big Clock, but that whole, like, someone investigating themselves, because he's not necessarily sure what he's been up to. He's got little periods of missing time that he goes through, and they don't really say that too explicitly, at least to me, in the 13th Floor movie. They say it a lot more in the book when he does black out quite a few times in the book. He blacks out almost as much as Dick Powell does in Murder, My Sweet. And I, you know, that's quite a bit. So, but I like those different levels that we have. I especially like the Vincent D'Onofrio character. I like that he is so completely different from world to world, where we don't necessarily see a huge difference between like the Armin Mueller-Stahl character, just because we don't see him a whole lot in the 1999 world. We see him more in the older world. And, well, I guess Gretchen Mol has a lot of differences between her variations as well. But I especially liked Vincent D'Onofrio in this one.
Yeah, I think he does a great job in this. And I really appreciate, as you were saying, you know, how he's developed sort of two different characters depending on where he's at within either the simulation world or the real world. And I think that that's one thing that helps the film in a way, because at times, and I know there's a certain level of confusion that obviously is built into the story, but you can kind of tell at times where you're at based on how D'Onofrio's acting, and that kind of helps. The one thing that, when it comes to the film, that I feel about with it is at times it kind of feels like there are things missing. I don't know if you got this feeling at all, that maybe there were more scenes, maybe there were storylines that were a little more fleshed out, and some of that stuff got pulled out. And I think, I mean, I don't necessarily know if there are a huge amount of deleted scenes with this film, but I kind of feel at times that it does take some leaps, and I'm often trying to figure out how it all fits together. It's either that, or it's just sort of the aspect of what they're trying to accomplish with the idea of the simulation in real world.
Yeah, the original screenplay, I had the fortune to look at that, and it's a little bit more tight when it comes to a detective novel in two parts kind of thing. And you really, I think the most confusing thing for me rewatching the movie recently is the transformation of Douglas Hall, because obviously it's very easy when Hall goes from 1989 to 1937, you know, he's got the mustache and he's very different when he is the person that he's taking over in 37 versus his personality in the present. And why he's taking over someone with a different name in the past is kind of weird. He's taking over this person that looks almost exactly like him but has a mustache, but he has a completely different name. You would think that if they were going to build simulations of these people, that they would actually have the same name, so it'll be a little bit less confusing if you were to take over your simulation, that people wouldn't be calling you by a different name. But I don't know. I'm not the computer programmer, so.
You know, one of the things that I thought may have been an interesting way to take this, and this obviously would have borrowed from another film, or actually a TV show, that had the idea of going into simulated worlds, or actually it was more time travel, but I thought that it would probably work better in here, was something like Quantum Leap, where when they would go to a different time, he would appear to us, Scott Bakula would appear to us as him, but when he went by a mirror or something like that, we would get the image of the other person. So we would understand the difference between him as this person in that time versus who he's portraying within that time.
I can totally see that. And I can see, though, even with the way that this is happening, I can see Bierko really pulling it off when he goes back in time. And I can see D'Onofrio really pulling it off in either timeline. I just have a little bit of trouble sometimes when we get later on in the film and we have Bierko's user, Douglas Hall's user, coming from the future, this third level that we mentioned briefly before, this 2024 timeline taking over Bierko. And obviously, we don't know what this guy looks like. He could look like Craig Bierko. He could look like Gregory Peck. We don't know what this guy looks like. So it's just a change of personality for him. And since he is not trying to let the cat out of the bag, he's basically trying to be Bierko, but just a little, you know, a little bit different than he necessarily is, a little bit more sadistic. So, and we don't know Douglas Hall that well as a character. I know that we believe he's a nice guy, But then when he starts to change the way that he moves, the way that he acts and everything, we're like, well, maybe we didn't know this guy that well, rather than, you know, immediately leaping to the conclusion of, oh, he's being taken over by somebody else in the future. I mean, we get that flash in their eyes. Thank God that we get that flash in their eyes. Or there's other times where it's like, what the hell just happened to this person? They completely changed personalities.
Obviously, I'm going to be nitpicky geek here, but the 2024 section, I thought there were two things that kind of pulled me out of 2024. And one was, there's a newspaper in 2024?
Yeah.
I can barely get newspapers delivered to my house 3 days a week here in Detroit. That was the first issue. The second was, there's a phone call made from a corded phone inside of a house in 2024. As we record this, this is 2012. This movie was made in 1999, okay? I understand that. But at least they could have had a futurist come in and give them a little bit of, okay, in 20 years from now, this is probably what's going to be the deal. You're probably going to get most of your news online, and that phone that's in the wall, that ain't going to exist anymore. It's going to be in your pocket. And not only is it going to be in your pocket, but it'll be your computer too. So you'll be reading your newspaper on your phone while you're talking on the phone.
I found it very funny that in the screenplay, they call the simulation the site, S-I-T-E, and it's all caps. And I can't remember exactly what it stands for. Very similar to, obviously, a website. And so I was like, okay, they're a little bit ahead of the curve here. You know, it's 1999. You know, most people are saying, okay, yeah, the web really kind of started in 95, 96, somewhere in there. You know, like the more popular version of the web, not the Tim Berners-Lee kind of version of it. But yeah, so they're using the terms like jacked in and stuff. So I'm like, yeah, they're kind of hip and everything. But yeah, you're right. When they get to the future, but we should probably say too that the future, that this ending that we're seeing here, what I would call the Wizard of Oz ending. The reason why I call it the Wizard of Oz ending is that he wakes up in the one that we see theatrically, wakes up and, you know, Gretchen Mol's there, and he opens up the window and there's Armin Mueller-Stahl is there. And I was waiting for like Vincent D'Onofrio to show up. So I'd be like, oh, I just had the greatest dream and you were there.
And you were there. But you couldn't have been, could you?
It's not the original that they were going with. And with that, they left a lot more to the imagination. We'll go ahead and we'll post the original ending to the website, projection-booth.com. And folks can see that it was not this kind of, you know, oh, we're going to open up the window and it's going to be bright and beautiful. Again, thinking of like Blade Runner when they leave the city and it's wonderful and beautiful outside of the city. It's like, why isn't everybody living out here?
What's going on? Well, actually, the alt ending kind of reminded me of, in a way, the end of Brazil. And I know that Brazil's much darker in its ending. But as I'm watching it and I'm looking at the design on this, and you can obviously go see it at projection-booth.com, is I thought of, by the way the walls looked, it looked like he was in a padded cell. Where when you get to the end, it's like he's not in the simulation. He's in the madhouse now. And he has this sort of strange look in his eyes. So you get this feeling that it was all in his head to begin with. I don't know.
I enjoyed 13th Floor. I just think that there are some inherent problems to it. But I definitely found some things of interest with this one.
See, and I liked it too. I'll go back and look at it again. I know that at some point. But it's not something that's going to be at the top of the queue when I've got 1,200 other things to look at. So we're going to take a break and play an interview that Mike did recently with star of the 13th Floor, Craig Bierko.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Hi, Dave Nelson, host of the Comedy Go-Go podcast, whose previous guests include
Hey, this is Carlos Alzaraki, James Garcia from Reno 911.
Hey, this is Graham Elwood.
Hey, this is Kyle Canadian.
Hi, this is Jackie Cation.
This is TJ Miller.
Hey, this is Nick Vatterott.
So if you fancy yourself a comedy fan, maybe even a comedy nerd, check out the podcast at www.comedyagogo.com or on iTunes under Comedy A Go Go. And remember,
yeah, it's a go go, all right? It's not a went went, all right? It is current current, all right? Listen to me on the podcast. I feel like that's what I write.
Hey fans, this is Reverend Scott. Just want to tell you about Outside the Cinema. Great company. They review cult films, any cult film, every cult film. And it's something you should tune into. So if you get a chance, go to the website, look these guys up, Outside the Cinema, and find out what the hot cult films are today, what's going on. These guys are right on the cutting edge of reviewing cult movies. And if you're a cult member, or you want to be a cult member, you're thinking about being a cult member, your mom's a cult member, your dad's a cult member, your damn mother-in-law's a cult member, tune in to Outside the Cinema, baby, and you'll find out what's going on. Reverend Scott, and that's out.
Can you tell me how you got the role, what you thought of the script when you saw it, and kind of how you were going to approach this thing when you decided that you're going to do it?
That's actually a pretty funny story, and not one I'm particularly proud of. I don't even know if I've ever told this before, but auditions tend to come in clumps. I don't know why, but you'll get, listen, if you're lucky, you'll get anything. But, you know, at this particular time, I think I had like three or four auditions, not stacked up in a day, but, you know, certainly in a couple of days. Plus, I might have been doing some TV work. So it was a pretty busy time. And certainly at that point in my life, I wasn't Captain Time Management. And, you know, usually something would fall by the wayside, and it would just be, you know, sort of a what do they say in the Army if there's an acceptable casualty? There's a term for that. But that was basically... the feeling was, oh man, this script seems kind of cool. Didn't have time to read it. Don't really have a sense of what's going on in the scene because, as you know, it's a little complicated. You know, it's sort of a matrix over a matrix, and reveal after reveal. And you kind of, you know, once you're hip deep in the movie, you really don't know who's who, which is kind of the fun of it. But I didn't know squat when I went in for the audition. So I went right in to meet the producers and the director, Joseph Resnick. Whatever I did, I probably felt like I was just treading water. But I got the call that it was between me and one other guy who was at that time certainly more established. And then I got the call that they were going to go with me. I didn't go back in to audition. They just went with me. And it was shocking because I remembered not really knowing. I really didn't know who I was talking to or what I wanted in the scene, which is fairly essential in acting, kind of important in life. You know, I knew I wanted the part just because it was the part. But I really wasn't going about it very intelligently, to say the least. And I got it. And now I had to read the script. I read the script, and I really, really liked it. It took me a time or two to read it, but I got the part without knowing what was going on in the 13th floor. That's how I got the part. When I found myself in a conversation with Joseph, and he had said, you know, the reason we chose you is because you made choices during your audition that no actor made, no other actor made, because that made me... they'd made the mistake of acting. I guess they had prepared, they'd done what they had studied. It's not the way I choose to go about things. Even at the height of sort of taking things lightly in that kind of situation when there was a pileup like that, it's a very uncomfortable experience to take up people's time and realize, you know, everybody in this room has invested money, time, and they want you to be great. And if you haven't invested in bringing it, you know, bringing something into the room, it can be shameful. And I'm not proud of that's how I got the part, but boy, did I feel lucky to be doing it. You know, I stumbled into something terrific, but I did stumble into it.
Did you wing it, would you say, or just kind of said, all
I
right?
I didn't, well, you know, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good under pressure, and I wonder sometimes. It's still there's still no excuse for it. You know, there's no excuse for not working. You know, in the end, you have to work and you have to prepare. I think when I was younger, and I think it's and it can be a bad habit for any actor, but the you can mistake being under pressure and what your mind. There's an illusion that your mind is actually absorbing more information than any other time because. You know, there's nothing at stake if you have a lot of time. I don't want to get too philosophical or boring, really, but there was, I think what I used to do is I used to wait to that last moment. And it was a bad habit I got into at school. I could sort of skate by and cut as many corners as possible and create a solution that I'd have a better time than anybody. And it's not really true. What you end up doing is creating an enormous amount of pressure for yourself. I think you can make yourself pretty sick, actually. But it was one of those rare wormholes I happened to fall into where it worked out for me. You know, it worked out. I ended up in a movie where I had the weight was completely on my shoulders. It was the first time. And to say the least, I needed to understand everything that I was doing. And it was not uncomplicated. You know, at that point, there was, you know, it's amazing, a movie that came out at the same time, little old independent flick called The Matrix. You know, it's amazing something that huge comes along. It changes the lexicon and everybody becomes familiar with an aspect of storytelling. And you sort of forget what it was like before that story came along. But, you know, The Matrix was kind of revolutionary, at least for me, in terms of a narrative. And spoke to a sort of a pre-internet paranoia. I mean, certainly the internet, you know, as we know it today, where everybody's hooked into Facebook and everybody's, you know, there was, I think at that point, I don't even know that I had email when I shot 13th Floor. I was relative, you know, I was one of the last guys to get a cell phone. And I'm way into the internet now. Now I love it, but I was a hard sell. So it's hard to relate to the time before that. Oh my God, I used to send letters and have to wait 2 weeks to find out if this girl liked me. You know, like I can't relate to that period of time. And that kind of storytelling, which was so complicated, where you've got, you know, a reality layered over another reality and then, you know, a different reveal at the end. And you know, while we were shooting it, they were contemplating, you know, different shades of even that. It got mind-bogglingly intense, and I kind of felt like, well, any lazy attitude I had during the audition process, karmically, I had to pay for instantly during the process. I had to stay on top of it. I often had to stop and, you know, figure out where I was and what I wanted in a scene. It was very helpful to work with somebody as cool as, you know, Gretchen Mol was terrific. Vincent was, you know, he's a terrific, terrific actor. Dennis Haysbert, you know, just one of my favorite people and solid, friendly. It was just a great group of people. I loved it. I was always surprised that it didn't do better than it did.
I've always wondered why that was, because it's such a solid narrative. The source is solid that it comes from, the book. The screenplay is tight, but I don't know if it was The Matrix undoing it, if it was what the situation was where it didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Honestly, you throw a stick in my career, you hit 30 of those, you know, projects. You never know. I'm now just happy to be working. Whatever success a project has or doesn't have, it's really, in a very serious way, it's just none of your business. It's all up to the public. It's up to, if you're lucky enough to, you know, have fallen into the zeitgeist, you know, and we may have been a second early or late. And you know, the world was accelerating at that point in a very, very big way. I mean, the internet, from as far as I'm concerned, it's no joke. The nature of time rolled over, became something different around that period. And I think The Matrix, when something like that comes along and articulates for the masses what seems to be happening in a much more subtle, complicated way, where the internet really is freeing up time and condensing it so that, you know, we're no longer waiting for the evening news to see what happened in China. We're actually watching something happen in China. There's no, the travel time between event and perception, it's a paper thin now. And if that's happening and two stories come out at the same time, it's sort of, you know what it reminded me of? It was sort of when I was in college in the 80s, they had, all of a sudden there were like 15 movies about fathers and sons switching bodies. It was the weirdest. I was like, who's in control? What strange, incestuous crap are all the studio heads trying to work out at the same time? You know, it's where every single son is inside their father. This is weird. But at any, you know, I hope it was something a little bit more innocent than that. But I remember thinking something happens with storytelling that's fascinating and is beyond our control. There's a need to tell and to receive stories. The antenna goes up and, you know, I think humanity receives stories it needs to hear at a certain time. So we may have been just ahead of or behind the curve. I thought The Matrix was terrific. For my money, I like things to be, not that our movie was, you know, sort of like an independent movie. First of all, it looked a hell of a lot more expensive than it actually was. But I liked the sort of slower noir, slowly unfolding human story. I happen to be a huge Matrix fan. I thought it was a terrific movie. But it's, you know, that was, those were just, those were punches. You know, you're just in the corner being pummeled by the movie, whereas this was, I felt like 13th Floor was a little bit more, a slower classic. It was like a great short story you stumbled upon.
When you guys were shooting this, I know that movies, of course, aren't shot in order, but was there any kind of attempt made to shoot the 1930s stuff all at once and then the 1990s stuff all at once, just so you could kind of stay in character a little bit more as you went through this?
You know, what's annoying is I would actually be able to answer your question accurately, but I just moved into a place and threw out a lot of this. Like, I came across like old schedules, shooting schedules and stuff, and I just got rid of all the stuff that would answer your question, because I don't remember if we did the 30s in a chunk. I know there were certain locations, you know, the junk shop, you know, right before we go to the Coconut Grove, you know, that were Armin Mueller-Stahl, yeah, who's also, you know, I don't know if you know, but he's just a novelist. Like, the man did everything, to the point of it just being annoying, because every time you walk in, he goes, oh, I also, you know, I paint murals, like, you know, whatever. If you need your car fixed, would you need your oil changed? The guy did everything. And he was so understated and weirdly heartbreaking in that movie, I thought. He's the heart of that movie. But anyway, I remember we shot that location, I think right before we went to the actual Coconut Grove. And the only reason I was happy was because I had to wear a damn wig whenever we went back in time. So it was kind of fun to come in earlier. I don't seem to remember doing all of that. You know, that stuff, another thing that was very impressive about that movie was the scenic design. There's a shot after I come out of the bank where you sort of get your first look, and Hall gets his first look at this world, what it's like to be inside of this world. And it's truly thrilling. And I think we had a block's worth of, you know, cars from the 1930s in downtown Los Angeles, which looks like a Mannix episode. You know, it looks like the 1930s in the middle of a Mannix episode when you're really there. But they painted such a beautiful, fully textured, convincing reality that when they actually panned back, you actually felt like you were there. And that was necessary for the story, you know. If it kind of looked like, you know, oh, God's going to wander to the edge and it's going to sizzle and crackle. I mean, you sort of had to forget the limitations that were. It's a shout out to those people. I don't remember their names, but I thought they did a really great job. Just a terrific looking movie. That was the thing about the movie that I remember being struck by, was that you really can't get a sense of if you're just an actor. You know, it's really none of your business. Is the overall feel of what you're taking a chance on. You're kind of laying a bet that, you know, everything, every element of the movie is going to support you. It's going to be well shot. You know, things like the scenic design, things that you're not thinking about at all. These things are all going to be seamlessly woven together by this terrific director. who I haven't seen since. I know he's done one or two things, but maybe you know. But I just thought this guy is going to be huge because he's made $12 look like $120 million. And you can only do that by making one right, correct choice after the other, because there's so many places it can all go topside, you know.
Not only did you get the role, but it was kind of a threefer, really. You got to be three different people in this one film.
Yeah.
Had you ever had to do multiple roles during one movie, and how easy or difficult was it to go from one person to the other?
Well, it wasn't as easy as it was during the audition when I was completely ignorant. you know, ignorance truly is bliss. It's also unemployment. Well, not in this case, but, you know, I loved it because my favorite thing that I was lucky enough to discover early in my career was playing against type. And that was all because Rennie Harlan, who I think is a very, very underrated director, made the strange choice of making the bad guy in this movie Long Kiss Goodnight that I did. He wanted that guy to just as close as he could get to a guy who stepped out of a Sears like underwear catalog, you know, just something kind of benign and beige, because he found that terrifying. And I got it. I absolutely knew what he wanted. And it took the pressure off of me to try to, you know, try and be Jack Nicholson or whatever my idea of a bad guy or something sinister was, and actually just be, you know, the person that I was, the kinds of characters that I was beginning to become frustrated with already, you know, these sort of the guys you want to take home to mom. He wanted that guy to have a, you know, sort of a sinister edge. And so by the time I did 13th Floor a couple of years later, I had that in my wheelhouse. I think at that point I had just worked with Dabney Coleman, who for my money is one of the great, in the history of film, one of the great comic bad men. He's also a terrific straight actor, but as far as a comic foil and bad guy, you know, mustache twirler, I think he's just the best. And so I got to take all of this stuff into this film. I got to be the kind of character which, frankly, you know, listen, you get the job, and if it turns out to be a success, you get to, you know, everything's nice because you're playing the hero. But you also get to be your own bad guy. I mean, it was just a dream come true. You know, everything that, you know, like fighting Vincent D'Onofrio was cool, but I was like, I also envied him too, because he got to make all these weird choices that I wasn't allowed to make. And I kept thinking, I just feel like I'm trying to be Harrison Ford here, who is terrific. But really, the best you can hope for playing a hero is to seem unsure that you're actually going to win. That makes it more exciting for the audience. And that's, I think, one of the many things that makes Harrison Ford a star, is that you actually believe he's in trouble and hasn't read the script. Like, you actually believe in Raiders every time he might not make it, that he has his moment. You know, that's a star. So I remember that even that gets a little thin on day, you know, 25. But by the end of the movie, I get to be Vincent. He's gone, and I actually get to take over his part. It was just terrific. I wish every movie was like that. I'm writing something now, actually, where I get to play everybody. It's a Zag's dream come true, you know.
All right, welcome back to the projection booth. It was a lot of fun talking with Craig Bierko about his work on the 13th Floor. We'll be talking to Craig again over the next few months about his role in The Long Kiss Goodnight. But in the meantime, be sure to stop by the projection booth website for more of our interview. You can hear more about Craig's roles in Scary Movie 3 and Cinderella Man. Apparently, he's reprising his role from Scary Movie 3 and Scary Movie 5. We're also going to have links over there for Easy to Assemble, Ileana Douglas's web series, where Craig plays a rather interesting role, too. Let's get back to the 13th Floor. Rob, we mentioned a few films before the break. We talked a little bit, I mean, briefly, Dark City, Matrix. What kind of comparisons are you seeing between Dark City and 13th Floor, other than just kind of that they were really coming out right around the same time?
Well, I think there's like a whole sort of blending of films that came out, I would say probably between like 97 and 2000. That deal with either alternate realities or the idea of playing in this sort of, you know, middle world, this sort of gray world between the waking life and sleep. And then also, I would say, even between the ideas of who one individual is and another. I don't know what was sort of in our cultural zeitgeist at the time. I think maybe we were coming up on the millennium and we're kind of questioning, okay, we've had 2,000 years of recorded history or something, and we're trying to figure out what the hell we're doing, as you know, the Y2K bug was supposed to make our toilets not flush anymore. So, you know, I don't know what was in the cultural zeitgeist then, but you had Dark City, you had, which was Alex Proyas's film with Rufus Sewell and Kiefer Sutherland. And that one I really like. I really like Dark City. It's a film I go back to because it has a lot of German expressionist roots. In that film, if you're not familiar, Rufus Sewell plays this man who's framed for murder and wakes up and finds out that he might not necessarily be who he is. And there are these creatures, these like the strangers or aliens or whatever, who dress very sort of like Peter Lorre and M with these hats and all this, and they're all bald, and they have the ability to stop time and change it, so they can take someone who's like a street person one day and then put them to be a millionaire the next day.
It's like Trading Places.
Yeah, it's like Trading Places, except they're not making bets on how they can screw over someone's life. So they do this, and then somehow Rufus Sewell's character is one of the few people who has the ability to like not fall asleep when the aliens are doing this, the strangers. So he sort of weaves his way through this world and figures out that, you know, maybe this whole thing is just nothing more than a game or a simulation. Then obviously The Matrix, which I don't really want to talk that much about The Matrix, because, you know, if you were living in the Western world in 1999, and since you obviously know what The Matrix is. And then Existenz, I think there's really like two sort of art house films that kind of go into this. One is Existenz, which is Cronenberg's film, which I liked. I know some people really didn't. But in that, it's Jennifer Jason Leigh and Jude Law. And there's this thing with like a game where people can actually, of course, Cronenberg in his sort of horror of the flesh way, they have these controllers that they can like kind of plug. They can like plug into their spinal cord, and they can sort of manipulate these different things. And then there's sort of these different levels of reality. I think it's a beautiful mess of a film. And to be honest, I haven't seen Existenz in probably 7 or 8 years, so I can't really claim to be an authority on all the particulars of it. But I remember when I saw it, I was fascinated by it, but at the same time kind of felt like I feel about 13th Floor, where it needs a little more work. And then one that isn't, that you didn't put on the list here, that I think sort of melds in with all of this idea of personality and walking around and sort of this, you know, reality within reality, and was art house, but obviously much more humorous, is Being John Malkovich, where you have Cameron Diaz and John Cusack, and Cusack in his little office on the 7.5 floor of this building finds that he can open up this door and go right into John Malkovich's head and walk around. And you learn through time that this portal has been used as a sort of a gateway to immortality, so that people sort of leap into people and then sort of live out their lives behind other people's eyes. So it's a really interesting, strange, surreal film that Charlie Kaufman wrote. So I think, like I said, I don't know what the hell was going on in, you know, 1997, 98, 99, and 2000, but we definitely had some angst and anxiety, it appears, about, you know, the ideas of individual, the ideas of, you know, virtual versus the real, and sort of that dark place between, you know, waking life and sleep.
I don't really think, and I know it's going to sound trite, but I don't think that we can underestimate the power of the internet at this time. I mean, this is, the internet is being hailed as this, you know, brand new, wonderful thing that's going on. And this is pre-dot-com. This is before the marketplace, you know, before we realized that all of these stocks were completely overvalued and it was mostly tech stocks were the ones that were. This is back when Pets.com is buying these, you know, million-dollar ads on the Super Bowl, and everyone's just like, you know, is buying into the hype of this whole, to me, kind of this heightened reality, this other world that we're kind of creating. And, you know, because 97, I think, is actually the year I got into net development. And by 99, it was like every business has to have a website now. And so much commerce had moved, you know, from the real world to the internet, and it was just, you know, Amazon and CD Now and all these things, you know, were really just like getting their hooks into us and everything. I know CD Now was a thing of the past, but it's still fun to kind of bring up some of these old school websites. But I think that was just one of many factors. I think you're right as far as the whole millennial thing too, and also the idea that all of this new tech that we had, all these new toys, were going to be taken away by this whole millennial bug thing that was going to happen. And oh my God, you know, now everything's going to be wiped out. All of our fun that we're having online and all of our bank accounts. And I think we were just kind of realizing too, with all of these things kind of plugging into each other finally, just how much of our lives had already started to go into this electronic format. Even without the internet, all of our bank accounts were kind of moving towards that, and you could call up your Visa company and, you know, do that, you know, rudimentary thing of checking your balance via the phone. So I think that has something to do with it. But yeah, it's bizarre that all of these films were all just kind of reflecting this stuff back to us in so early in this cycle. And it's funny too, I would just want to go back to Dark City. I'd forgotten about Rufus not fall asleep and avoiding these kind of bad guys, you know, the Richard O'Brien type characters while he's doing that. That's exactly how our main character in Frederick Pohl's Tunnel Under the Sky kind of figures out what's going on, is because he falls asleep someplace that isn't his normal place that he falls asleep, and comes to, you know, not be reprogrammed at the end of the night. Every morning when he wakes up, it's June 15th, and one night he falls asleep in his basement, which is lined with metal. It's kind of, you know, Night of the Comet-esque there. He's lined with metal, and the next day he wakes up, he thinks it's June 16th, but no, it's still June 15th. And the weirdest thing about that is that I have a friend of mine who was bugging me to read that story for years, like literally years. He was telling me how good this short story is. I finally picked it up and started reading it, and wouldn't you know, I was reading it on June 15th.
There you go. See, one of the things you can also say about Dark City is that you can take the idea of him not being able to fall asleep as a metaphor and move it forward to say that it could be a comment on society, the idea that, you know, complacency or the idea of going along would be falling asleep. You know, like, what's one of the things that you hear? I mean, okay, do the right thing. What's the big line from Spike in there where he screams, "Wake up!" You know, it's like, that's what they're always talking about. You know, when we talk about politics, it's about waking people out of their sleep. So you could even put some metaphors on top of Dark City in that way, in terms of his insomnia, meaning that he's aware of things.
Well, that's the same thing that they were doing with The Matrix when Neo takes the pill and is suddenly able to kind of wake up out of his slumber where he had been living for all of these years in that goo. And you would think that his muscles might have atrophied by that time and he couldn't stand up, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, he's finally waking up and seeing what the real world is like, and nobody else that he had been living with for all these years had been able to see it at all.
You know, we talked about the idea of all of this technology sort of, the new technology was coming online in the mid to late 90s, which obviously plays into the background in this film, 13th Floor. And if you want to see something that is a fascinating documentary to watch, it's three parts, it's an hour long each, so it's about 3 hours, is Adam Curtis. He's a BBC documentarian, and he did a film series, is three parts, called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. Obviously, you know what that title is.
Yes, I do. A reference to Richard Brautigan.
That's right. And All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace is really fascinating because what Adam Curtis looks at is the development of that technology and how people on both the left and the right had looked at technology and these interconnected world that we were supposedly building, that was supposed to be our saving grace. It was supposed to be the thing that was going to bring all of us together and make a utopia. And what he basically comes to realize and explains to all of us is that it ain't happening. It's actually much worse than what you would even imagine. And it's a brilliant documentary. And Adam Curtis is a guy that if he's not on your radar, he's a guy you definitely want to watch. If you want to watch something really short by Adam Curtis, you should go to YouTube, type in Adam Curtis and Richard Nixon. And there's a 6-minute piece on there that probably distills all of his great ideas into one 6-minute piece. on how we've all turned into paranoid weirdos like Richard Nixon. And it's brilliant.
We had like a mini renaissance of these alternate reality films. I mean, of course, we still have kind of ever since 98, 99, we're seeing these films more and more often. And even before that, we had, and I hate to say it, Lawnmower Man. So we had some alternate reality things going on there and Johnny Mnemonic and all that kind of stuff. But it was really weird. Like for a little while there, I thought we were going to have more of a renaissance when we had Surrogates and Gamer both coming out right around the same time and both, you know, kind of taking over some, you know, you could go into these video games and take over these characters, or in Surrogates, you had a, you know, a robot double that you could take over and live your life through this robot double. But whatever, neither film really did that well at the box office, which was a shame because I enjoyed both of them, but neither one were to be. I mean, I guess there just weren't enough explosions and stuff in them. So we can look at those in context with these other films, but let's go ahead and we'll take a step back in time instead and go all the way back into the 70s and look at World on a Wire, which was Rainer Werner Fassbinder's adaptation of Daniel Kaluuya's same source novel, Simulacron 3, and he released it. I'm not going to try the German, but it translates to World on a Wire.
The one thing I thought was great was I was obviously watching 13th Floor, and I'm watching all these names go by in the credits, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I'm like, you have Michael Bauhaus, who's a noted DP. He shot a bunch of films, 22 different films for Fassbinder. Now, Fassbinder was pretty prolific considering he didn't live that long. He made movies from 1969 to 1982. He made a couple of shorts before 69, but that was his time making features. He died in 1982 due to a drug overdose, and during that time made 40 films. He made up to 5 movies a year at some points, and it wasn't like he was making short little 90-minute films. I mean, one of the this one, World on a Wire, is 2 parts. It's 3.5 hours because it was a 2-part TV, made-for-TV film that he made over in Germany. He is probably best known for such films as Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, Year 13 Moons, Why Does Herr R. Run Amok, Berlin Alexanderplatz, which I think is 12 hours, 13 hours. It was a miniseries that he did. So, I mean, he was making a lot of films. As a matter of fact, it's my understanding that one of my favorites of his, Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, was done in about a week. And he did that because he was trying to get another project going and couldn't get it going. So this was a guy who was just constantly working. And that's why, it's my understanding, if I remember his biography correctly, I think he died on the editing room table. He was on a lot of drugs. And depending on who you talk to, one of his connections, at least I think when he was in the States, was a Dreamlander, Cookie Mueller, who we'll all remember from Pink Flamingos, as I heard. Fassbinder's work is really interesting. He's part of the whole New German Cinema, which includes people like Wim Wenders and Werner Herzog, Fassbinder, Welker Schollendorf, who did The Tin Drum. So there were all these German directors who came out basically between the late 60s and when he died. As a matter of fact, people have put chronologically the death of New German Cinema as 1982 with the death of Fassbinder, because they believe that the films that came out in that period from basically about 66, 67 through 82 sort of encapsulate a solid idea. I would say that Fassbinder is probably my second favorite director of the New German Cinema. Werner Herzog would be the first. What's really interesting when you read about New German Cinema or you hear interviews with people like Wenders or definitely with Herzog, is he says that, you know, the war really destroyed any sort of continuity for us, in that unlike in America where you had filmmakers from the 40s during the war period who instructed and trained and did all these things for the kids who were coming up. Obviously, as we will be talking to Peter Bogdanovich soon, and that was obviously the case with Orson Welles. huge influence, Orson Welles, on Peter Bogdanovich. The German directors who came up in the 60s as part of New German Cinema, they didn't have that. So a lot of them had to go back even further. They had to go back and look at silent film from their own country first, and then look to the French, look to America for places of inspiration.
Well, there was such a brain drain when it came to the war and just how many German filmmakers emigrated to England and the United States from that. I mean, we got Karl Freund out of that. We got Fritz Lang out of that. I mean, if this was a baseball thing, you know, we really kind of upped our team with all of the folks that were coming over from the German team.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, it wasn't that they wanted to come over here. They came over here, obviously, because when Ufa was taken over by the Nazis, it became just a propaganda factory. And there were very few films that came out during that period when Goebbels was running it that are of any real true merit artistically and of any real value. So you end up with, you know, the pre-war era, and then you end up with New German Cinema. So it takes a while for post-war Germany, once the economic miracle happens, as they called it, after World War II, to get its legs back under the country, and then for film to really start to come into its own and have its own flavor again. So, like I said, Fassbinder was part of that. Michael Ballhaus, as I said, one of the producers on The 13th Floor. Armin Mueller-Stahl had worked with Fassbinder on Lola and Veronica Voss as part of a trilogy of films that Fassbinder did in the 70s. And there's other sort of smaller connections. If you look at some of the people who were working on this production, they probably were informed by Fassbinder in some way. Roland Emmerich, and there's all this German connection into this film. And I'm sure that when they were putting this together, it just wasn't a coincidence that World on a Wire was there. You know, it was probably heavily in the background for them. And they looked at World on a Wire and said, this is a really interesting film, really interesting concept that Fassbinder had done in 1970, around 1975, and must have thought to themselves, there's got to be a commercial way to take these ideas of what he does in this film and to put them forward. So maybe we should talk a little bit about some of the differences between the two.
The look of the film, I mean, I think obviously we're talking about the differences. That's the major difference, is just how beautifully shot this thing is, and the cool blues to it. This kind of, it's science fiction, but it's not set in this kind of futuristic world. There are very few things that are kind of telling us that this is a world that is different than ours, but it is, it's similar but different, to put it one way. So it's interesting how they kind of set it apart from the everyday world of Germany at this point.
And this is the thing, once again, as I was talking about how New German Cinema had to kind of look west. And when he was doing this, he was looking at something like Alphaville, because Eddie Constantine, who plays Lemmy Caution in Godard's Alphaville, is actually in World on a Wire. He's got a couple of scenes in there. And the thing that I really like about it is that this is a film that you don't need all that crazy over the top, you know, special effects like we do here in the States in order to pull it off. All you need is a little bit of sound, some flashing lights, some Dutch angles, and all of a sudden you know that you've created this new universe. And that's the thing that I really appreciated about Alphaville the first time I saw it, is, you know, that's like shot as almost like documentary as you can on the streets of Paris, and somehow Godard puts it into your head that this is supposed to be in some sort of alternate world. So I think Fassbinder does a really nice job with it. And one of the things that's great, as you were saying about the cinematography, is the camera has this tendency to kind of do two things in the film. One is it's either locked down or it's constantly moving. And then at the same time, there's a lot of windows, mirrors. It's incredible when you consider that it's so hard to make sure the crew and the mic, cameras, all that stuff isn't showing those reflections. And the thing is as you get into the second part, of World on Wire, it gets more and more to the point where he's bouncing people off things. Where there's one dialogue scene where he's talking to the woman on the right side of the screen, but we see her on the left side of the screen in the mirror. So he's constantly working with this idea of perception. Are we seeing, or are we in the reality? Are we in the simulation? And sort of how he just kind of ramps it up as we get further along.
The reflections draw attention to themselves after a while, just because there are so many. But I like that it's this kind of constant reminder to you. You're not this passive viewer. You're more of an active viewer as you're saying, look at all these reflections. Look at how he's using glass. Look at how he's using mirrors. What's that woman doing with a hand mirror while she's laying in bed? You know, everybody's got a mirror or something where we're seeing them. We're seeing them shot through something else where they're being distorted. I mean, his secretary, the main character's secretary, we often see her being distorted, and she's usually very close to the frame or kind of being blown up a little bit when we're seeing her. And I like that. That's the special effect, you know, having this kind of constant reminder in our faces is what is giving this whole thing this kind of sense of irreality, rather than, yeah, the fancy kind of stuff that we're seeing with later on films. You know, we're not seeing the whiz-bang kind of stuff of The Matrix. We're seeing just this kind of lo-fi but really well-done version of it. And I have to say, as far as adaptations go, this is much closer to what Galluy was doing in his book. I mean, sometimes down to some of the dialogue, a lot of the beats. I mean, there's a character at a party that is talking to our main character, our Douglas Hall character, and the main character turns away for just a brief second, turns back, and that guy is gone. And then a lot of it is his investigation trying to find what happened to this guy and why did he disappear, what happened to their mutual boss. He had, you know, committed suicide, some people say, and other people say that he was murdered. This guy who disappears from the party says he's murdered. So it's nice that we kind of keep some of those same things that Galluy was doing in the book, and our main character goes and reports it to the police, and later on the police don't remember this at all. So it's like he's been wiped off the map. So it kind of is a nicer, you know, it really gives us more of a clue up front, and really our poor protagonist is not as smart as us as viewers should be, that there's more going on than what he necessarily sees. So, I mean, that the book was called Simulacron 3, and they call it that for, you know, oh, this was the third version of it. I mean, it gives you a hint right off the bat that there are three levels to this thing, and then who's to know if there's not 4, 5, 6, 7 infinity of levels going on to this whole what is reality question.
In the second part, there's a music cue that any film fan would know that plays on this idea of what sort of version of reality are we looking at, with sort of this Rashomon idea is you hear it for a quick second when the character is going to visit someone, is the third man theme.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of homages to older films in this film. I mean, there's that whole scene where he walks into the bar and the woman is singing the Marlene Dietrich song from Destry Rides Again.
It's great. I mean, there's all these different things in there. We were talking about all these surfaces and the reflections and the lighting and all this stuff. Michael Bauhaus, right? Michael Bauhaus produces 13th Floor. So you have this thing where the cinematographer of this film is the producer of the 13th Floor. So there's this massive connection between the two. Would have been nice if maybe he could have shared some notes that Fassbinder had, and maybe they could have tied the two together a little bit tighter in terms of how to do this. But obviously, I mean, they were looking at what they could do within a Hollywood context. And like I said, I mean, I think 13th Floor works really well. As for World on a Wire, for me, it's just an amazing piece to watch. It's a little overlong for me at times. I think he's got a lot of ideas in it, but if you want to get into Fassbinder, there's a lot of great places that you can watch. And I would say, for me, my favorite one of all, and I had already referenced it, and as a matter of fact, he's in World Unaware, is Ali Firit's The Soul. That's probably my favorite Fassbinder film. The lead character is Moroccan, Hedi bin Salim. And he's the Arab-looking guy who follows around. He's one of the private investigators, the detectives in World on a Wire. And actually, as an interesting background, he moved from Morocco to Germany and was actually Fassbinder's lover for several years. I'm not sure if Fassbinder was completely gay or if he was bi. He had sort of a wife or a girlfriend and then had several different male lovers. So they were together for a while, and then years later, He ended up getting thrown out of the country and ended up back, I think it was in France, and ended up dying in prison. So rather tragic story with him. He was a great actor. I mean, he did a really nice job, I think, for the small part he has in here. But obviously about a year later in 1974, when Fassbinder does Ali Fear Eats the Soul, really gives an amazing performance, which also is connected, as we're talking about, with 13th Floor and connected back. Ali Fear Eats the Soul is a remake of Douglas Sirk's All That Heaven Allows. So, and then obviously a few years ago, as I referenced with Dennis Haysbert, you have Far From Heaven, which, so that even goes back to All That Heaven Allows. So you have another connection with all these weird films. So
all cyclical, man. It's all cyclical.
See, we're inside the simulation. That's why I asked you at the beginning, was it live or is this Memorex? So there you have it. Our insane month of September here on the Projection Booth continues with a special show all about Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. Be sure to tune in and hear what you and your fellow listeners have to say about Scott's film, because we did take your phone calls, and we'll be doing that more and more as we go along here on the Projection Booth. And when we ask you to call in, make sure you call in, because we want to hear from you.
Yeah, and when we say call in to leave comments, please call in, send us a MP3 or something, because we're not going to go through all the, you know, the news groups and Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and stuff and compile all those and read them in our voices. We would rather hear the voice of the people, as it were. So when we say leave a voicemail, leave a voicemail.
And it's free when you call from work.
Exactly. So, and also be sure to come back next week on a regular day for The Haunting of Julia. We'll be joined by guest co-host Kayla Janice as we talk to her about this macabre film and her book, The House of Psychotic Women. It's a wonderful amalgamation of film criticism and autobiography, her book that is, and not Haunting of Julia. That's a totally different thing. And if you want to check out The Haunting of Julia before the show airs, it's over on Netflix Instant, what do you know, as is The 13th Floor.
We want to thank this week's special guest, Craig Bierko, for coming on the show. We'd like to thank you all for listening, of course, and thank you for providing us this wonderful hour of free entertainment, or actually a little more than an hour for us. But, you know, we hope you have fun during this hour when we're talking, get some insights as well into maybe a movie you heard of, maybe a movie you really like. Yeah, pass along the recommendation to others, but also make sure you pass along the recommendation for the Projection Booth. That's projection-booth.com. You can also find us on iTunes and leave us a review. We like reviews. And give us a star, because every single one counts.
Yes, every star is sacred.
I thought those were sperm.
Those two. Я твой Снуда, я твой работник.